Well, I wonder what you make of that. Now, I have to confess that whenever my Bible readings take me to a list of names like that, I used to groan inwardly. 70 verses of Ezra 2, most of which are purely names. And I have to admit, they're hard going to read these names, not just because they're difficult to pronounce, which they are and still remain so, but it's difficult to know actually what the Lord is saying to us. Difficult to know why a list like this is important and these names appear in this form in the Bible. Difficult to know how a passage like this might reveal Jesus to us, might nourish us in our faith, might bring us comfort when we mourn, might help us to articulate the joy, might spur us on in our journey of faith. How might a list of names give us something to offer to someone else? How can these list of names possibly help us share the good news that Jesus is risen from the dead? But the key that unlocked it for me, and I guess it might be different for you, but the key that unlocked it for me was a visit to one of Orkney's South Isles. I went to the Tomb of the Eagles in South Romsey. And while we were in the gift shop, being the sort of person I am, I'd read things that are on the wall, and there was this sort of framed text on the wall. And it was a portion of the Orkney Inga saga. And it begins like this. There was a king named Forjot, and he ruled over the lands called Finland and Kevinland, that is to the east of the Bright Sea, which goes northward, the Gavadik, that is Helensbright. Forjot had three sons, Herm, who we call Agar, the second Logi, and the third Cari. His father was Frost, the father of snow of old, and his son's name was Thori, and he, that is Thori, had two sons. Their names were Nor, and the other Gore, and his daughter's name was Goai. And in that moment, I got it. I realized the importance of a list of names. It's about credibility. If I'm writing a document in ages of old, and I want you to believe what I am saying, I give it credibility. And this list of names gives to the reader that credibility. It says, look, you know what I'm talking about here. There is truth in what I am saying because you know these people. You know who this person is, and you know their father. You know of their grandfather, and you know of the stories of old. They are our shared inheritance. If I want you to believe what I'm saying, in days of old, I set down a list of names that gives it credibility. I appeal to the fact that you know who these people are. And therefore, because you and I have a shared heritage with these people, actually, we have a shared story. And you can believe what I'm about to tell you. Now, of course, these names in Ezra chapter 2 mean little to us in 21st century Cambridge. But to the people of ancient Israel, these names were significant. They're family names. Most of all, these are the names of people who have returned from exile. 70 years after the nation had been overrun and the people had been wrenched from their homes and carried off to a foreign land, their cities had been sacked, their temples plundered, the people carried into exile. This list of names are the survivors. These are the people who've returned. This is a record of their existence. This is a testimony of a God who keeps his word, who judges their infidelity, carries them into exile, and keeps them safe. until they return. This is a God who, when the time is right, changes the heart of a government in a land and introduces a ruler who is warm to a people's return. This, then, is a list of survivors. They may not be the elderly, the over 70, those who went away into exile, who remember what it was like to no longer live in their land. They may not be the people who lived long enough to see the return. Indeed, this list suggests that all these folk are second or third generation of those who were carried away. But they are, nevertheless, the survivors. As we reflect on this passage this morning, as we begin to ask what the Lord might say to us, the first thing I want to say is that we are survivors. If you read church history, you will see that from 1960s, the whole ethos of church into this country took a nosedive. Now, I know that during the 1980s or so, as a church, you bucked the trend. You had a spurt of growth when everyone else was declining. But since then, there have been all sorts of reasons, and our numbers have followed the numbers of just about the rest of the country. There's a host of reasons for that. There's a host of reasons why the church in this country is declining. But we are the survivors. Not only are we the survivors of a wholesale church decline in this country, we're also the survivors of a pandemic. If an apathy towards what God is doing is not significant enough, the challenge is not a significant challenge for the church as a whole. The fact that we've been weathering the storm of a pandemic that has caused us to close our buildings for a while, caused our congregations to be dispersed, has made it very difficult to meet in person. If in a pandemic we had to find different ways to be church, when we couldn't sing and still can't sing as we gather now, when we have to wear a face mask and keep distance from one another, when we have struggled with new technology as a result, folk have become disconnected in person. It's not surprising that we have lost some folk along the way. It's not surprising that we've become that. The sense of disconnectedness that comes with being encouraged to stay at home, to wear face coverings, to keep your distance, has meant that there is a danger of becoming disconnected from our faith, disconnected from God. That disconnectedness has been a constant companion with us as we have lived through a time of pandemic. We are the survivors. We are the surviving remnant. We are the few who have remained faithful, who have clung to our faith, whatever the pressure to do otherwise has been. We have survived the pressure of church decline and the ravages of a pandemic. If you were to list our names, we would be the list of survivors. But by that very act of describing us as survivors, there's a presumption that some haven't survived, that some will have drifted far from their faith and cannot be called back. The fact that some will have succumbed to the virus and will have passed from this life to the next. And with that brings a sense of sadness, a sense of regret. There is always sadness along with loss. The mourning of a loved one lost to this dreadful pandemic. The mourning the fact that many of the seats that were once full are now empty. The regret there is something that we have left undone. left unsaid. The regret that because of the regulations, we were not able to be there when a loved one passed from this world to the next. Regret that we did not do more to reach out, to make sure people didn't drift away, didn't drift from their faith, didn't become disconnected. The very act of describing ourselves as survivors recognizes that some of us haven't. And with that comes a sense of sadness and regret. And that's reflected here in Ezra 2. This list of those who have survived exile and are now returning to the land is rather than being one list, is actually multiple lists. There are two key parts to this list as well, these multiple lists. From the second part of verse 2 to verse 58, we have those who can prove their ancestry. That is, whether they're descended from lay people that were carried away into exile, verses 2 to 20. Lay people defined by their origin, where they've come from, verses 21 to 35. Or those that are descended from clergy, priests, Levites, temple gatekeepers, temple servants, servants of Solomon, verses 36 to 58. And then there are those who have become disconnected, who've lost their family records. Those people who were lay people with no family roots, verses 59 to 60. The clergy who've become disconnected from their ancestry and by association their role, verses 61 to 63. Notice also, this list is impersonal. It's just a list of family names. And sometimes, not even that, sometimes just associated with regions of the country that they think they come from. Some have retained their family connection, and so the cost to being survivors is quite small. For others, the cost of becoming disconnected from their ancestors means the cost of surviving is high. Fact emphasized in verse 70, where the priests and the Levites and musicians and the gatekeepers and the temple servants settled in their own towns. Note that, own towns, along with other people and the rest of the Israelites who settled in their towns. Talking about their own towns looks back to Joshua and the taking of the promised land, a time when the land was divided up by family and everyone got their portion. Everybody got their inheritance. And providing you could prove your ancestry, this was your land. And now as you return from exile, if you can prove your ancestry, you can return to your land. But if you've become disconnected from your family, what then? What happens if you cannot prove your ancestry and you have returned to the land, but without tenure, and what tenure you have is far from secure? Leads me back again to this sense of disconnectedness that seems to occur again and again whenever I reflect on the storm that the pandemic has brought to us. And it draws out a question. Where have we become disconnected? Disconnected from the parts of the faith which once nourished us. Disconnected from the people who once encouraged us in our journey of faith. Disconnected from family members from whom we love and have not been able to visit in person for as long as a year now. I wonder what the cost has. And I wonder how that cost has affected our well-being. I wonder. But Ezra 2 is more than just a list of survivors, as important as that might be. The theologian Derek Kidner describes this list of names as the living portion of Israel's roots, ready for transplanting. Writing to a dispersed church in Asia Minor, the Apostle Peter says a similar thing. He says, as you come to him, the living stones rejected by humans, but chosen by God and precious by him, you also are like living stones being built into a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, offering spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. 1 Peter 2, 4 and 5. Not only are the returners, the survivors, actually those who go back to the land, they are the building blocks of the future. Locked up within these people in Ezra 2 is all the potential to rebuild the temple, to create a center again of worship, a place where God can be encountered. Locked up within us as survivors is all that the Lord needs to rebuild his church. While we might suffer the culture shock of having survived the onset of church decline, while we might have weathered the storm of a pandemic that has left us disconnected, disconnected from each other, disconnected from our families, disconnected in some ways from our faith, we are it. We are what the Lord has to work with. By his grace and mercy, we are the survivors, the building blocks, the foundation upon which Jesus will build his church. And as we recover from the shock of survival, as we deal with whatever survivor's guilt we might carry with us, the Lord will use us to be the seed of a new church that he is forming in this place. I wonder whether that's an encouragement to us. I wonder whether that gives us something to hold on to, something to reach out with and connect with. I wonder if there's something about the Lord's grace and mercy allowing us to survive that gives us the encouragement to rebuild. You see, there's another thing here in Ezra 2. Because whilst this is a list of the survivors of exile, whilst it speaks of a people rooted in their family ancestry or disconnected from family and people in place, these are a people bound together with a commitment to make it work. Verses 68 and 69 sort of point this out. When they arrived at the house of the Lord in Jerusalem, some of the heads of the family give free will offerings towards the rebuilding of the house of God in this site. According to their ability, they gave to the treasury for its work 61,000 darceries of gold, 5,000 minas of silver, 100 priestly garments. Many of the people who had survived exile had now returned to the land, and they're willing to put their hands in their pockets and contribute to the rebuilding of the temple. We touched on this a couple of weeks ago when we looked at how the government provided funding for the rebuilding of the temple in Ezra 1. Cyrus was able to provide whole rich resources upon the return. But now, when the people have returned, it's the heads of the families who also dip into their pockets and fund the rebuilding. It always interests me when I read passages like this, the little aside you find in it. And I'm interested, it says that only some of the heads of the family were made free will offerings. Makes me wonder why they didn't all, it doesn't say they all made offerings. Was it that some were reluctant to contribute? Or was it because of their disconnectedness, their lack of secure tender in land, they simply did not have the wherewithal to make any kind of offering? Notice that the writer, as he records this, says that the heads of the family gave out of their ability to give. This is not to be seen as a tax. It's not a burden to bear. It's a joyous gift. It's an expression of thanks upon a safe return. It's also a sign of commitment. of committing to rebuilding. And ask the question of us, if we are the survivors, if we are those who have survived the decline of the church, if we have survived the ravages of coronavirus, I wonder how committed we are to the idea, the concept, the process of rebuilding, of reconnecting to those whose faith has waned, who have drifted from us, drifted from the presence of God. I wonder if we ourselves are willing to offer something of ourselves. I wonder if we're willing to contribute time and energy and money that the church might be rebuilt. I wonder if we're willing to contribute to the level of which our means allow. I wonder. This passage in Ezra 2 is on one level a list of names that mean very little to us. On one level, these are a people far removed from those who we know and have connection with, and they offer us very little. And yet on the other hand, there's a depth and a richness to this list. Speaks to us of what it is to be a survivor, to survive with our connectedness intact, to survive but being disconnected in that survival. This list speaks of potential, the potential and the hope that the Lord has placed in us as survivors. And it speaks of commitment, the commitment to rebuilding their land, the temple, the place where they gather to meet with the Lord. This may be a list of names, but they are the survivors. And they have a lot to say to us as survivors. And so it leaves me wondering, as survivors ourselves, survivors of church decline, survivors of a pandemic, I wonder how we will respond to the Lord's call to reconnect and rebuild. I wonder. Amen.